to start a little bit with why we are here. This picture of this girl's head looks like she's exploding with questions. I think that's, again, reflected in that word cloud, how a lot of us are feeling right now. She seems very zen about it. We're hoping to get you to that place as well by the end of this presentation and by the end of today. So again, Miranda referenced this briefly, and I think it's just worth revisiting for those who are coming into this topic. As many of you, if not all of you, are aware, Chicago Tribune and ProPublica conducted an intensive investigation into the use of isolated timeout in Illinois schools, which was published on November 20th. They've published a follow-up article on restraint in December. And after the article was published, the state superintendent acknowledged that the practices of isolated timeout and physical restraint had been misused and overused to a shocking extent. That was ISBE's perspective. Responding to the article, Governor Pritzker called the isolation of children in the state appalling and said he directed ISBE to make emergency rules for schools. He also indicated plans to work with legislators, which we're seeing now, to make the rules into law. So again, emergency rules, which we're all familiar with, or all have a lot of feelings about, were issued, and they were effective immediately, which did cause a lot of scrambling on the part of school districts that were using these, both isolation and physical restraint. There was a considerable amount of confusion at the beginning, certainly. ISBE did then publish an FAQ document, which did provide some clarity to the emergency rules. ISBE proposed permanent rules on December 9th, and they are still open for public comment. So we are awaiting what rules eventually go for final approval. I'm going to turn it over to Kendra to pick us up.
Okay, thank you all for being here. I think, you know, one of the questions just to start with is, how will this affect my school or my district? Will it affect me? Kind of what is this really going to look like? How will it play out? And I think that depends a lot on what your practices were prior to these rules. And an important thing to know to start with is that the rules apply to all students, whether or not they have an IEP or a 504 plan. So all of these rules, if a student experiences timeout or physical restraint who is a general education student, all of these rules apply there as well. Now, if you have a student who does not have a 504 plan or an IEP, who is experiencing timeout or physical restraint, especially on a repeated basis, we should all have red flags waving, right? That this is a child find issue. We should be thinking about a case study. We should be thinking about a behavior plan, a safety plan, kind of taking those next steps, because it would be highly unusual to have a general education student using these interventions on a regular basis. Okay, so there's a lot of text on this slide, and you guys, I believe, have an electronic version, and there are some paper copies floating around. But I wanted to sort of frame it as, at the outset, when is it appropriate to use these interventions? And previously, under the old rules, they could be used as a means of maintaining discipline, maintaining a safe and orderly environment for learning, to the extent necessary to preserve the safety of students. And the change in the emergency rules, there are kind of two big changes. One is the removal of that orderly part, right? These interventions should not be used to maintain an orderly environment, to obtain student compliance, to get students to just generally be quiet and well-behaved and doing what they're supposed to be doing. They should be used for safety purposes. The other change is this addition of therapeutic purposes, which is, of course, not defined in the rules. And I think it's confusing, personally, exactly what that means and how it is distinguished from another time, a non-therapeutic use. Now, the ISBE FAQ did provide some guidance on this, and they said therapeutic purposes means that these interventions are being used in tandem with other positive behavior supports. I'm still a little bit confused, to be honest. We should always be using these with other positive behavior supports, right? This is not your first go-to tool out of your bag. This is something when a situation has escalated and there aren't any other options in order to keep everyone safe. So I think this is still a little bit murky, and if you look over to the far side with the proposed permanent rules, that language has been removed. And so I think, you know, this is a temporary piece of confusion we have, but looking at the final rules really encapsulates, I think, where this is moving, is that we are talking about emergency situations where there's an immediate safety threat. So I think kind of looking at that definition, even now it's not in effect yet, kind of gives you a good sense of the way to frame this and think about it.
And Kendra, that's someplace I'd just jump in with some practical concerns about how we're seeing this play out. So when it says positive interventions, we all have situations where if you gave the kid an iPhone and let them watch Netflix and not do math, the behavior will suddenly de-escalate, right? So positive intervention. However, what I'm getting is this student is never going to learn. We're basically never putting any demands to avoid this. So at what point is, you know, do we put a little bit of demand, try to get them to learn something, and then eventually staff just, here's what I'm afraid of, we're just going to give up. Okay, don't learn anything because this isn't worth it. And, you know, maybe we have a placement discussion or maybe we just don't see progress. So obviously this is extreme, you know, physical restraint in order to get a kid to learn is extreme, but at the same time we do get into this, okay, we're just going to back off this kid. And so I think that's just a thing in the back of our minds on both sides. There's a balance there, right? And we have to think about that when we're thinking about, okay, yeah, positive interventions, but at what point do we also require some learning? So.
Another question people have had is, you know, students who are being disruptive, they're yelling, maybe they're making threats, sort of that verbal aggression. You know, at that point, is it appropriate to use a timeout or a physical restraint? And that is the FAQ, and I think the general feeling is no. At that point, that's not a reason to use those interventions unless the student has taken some additional step to show they're going to follow through on that threat, that this verbal aggression is about to turn into physical aggression and cause an actual physical safety issue. And at that point, we'd be looking at moving to these more extreme interventions. You know, of course, I do want to just flag, that doesn't mean that verbal aggression or threats should just be tolerated. You do have your other disciplinary ways that you can follow through on those types of negative behaviors. So turning to isolated timeout, you know, the kind of obvious first step change from the old rules to the emergency rules was just taking a marker and crossing out isolated everywhere it appeared. Right? And I think that in itself, like, you know, that is the point. You're not doing isolated timeout anymore, but it also created some confusion, which we'll talk about in a minute. So your key factors here we're talking about timeout is when you have an involuntary confinement of a student in a separate location. It cannot anymore be locked or blocked. The student cannot be alone. It has to be monitored by a trained adult. It needs to be in that room. I think, you know, we had alarm bells going off. Well, we have students who are not safe when they are in timeout. And if I put an adult in a small space with a student who is so escalated and not engaging in safe behaviors, that is putting that adult at risk, which is a very real concern. And I think at that point, we need to be talking about other interventions, right? A timeout might not be an appropriate intervention for that student at that time if you can't safely have an adult in the room with the child. So we need to be stepping back and thinking about what other tools do we have? Do we need to have an IEP meeting? Do we need to bring in some other experts to figure out what do we do instead if that's not a viable intervention?
So another place to jump in and where we've seen this have maybe unintended consequences, some of our unions have pushed back and really are getting the message, so it's okay for us to get hit, for us to get clawed and injured and whatever, we can't. And now you're telling us to go into a room probably not safe, and it's okay for us to get beat on while we're in there. And so, I mean, this has escalated to the point I've met with one union. They asked for a special ed attorney to explain to their members what are the parameters, what is the district working with, and why is there so much difficulty in keeping them safe from these students? And so, you know, my number one message to the union had to be, it's not okay. No one is saying it's okay for a child to hit you. That is not the point of any of this. But there are a lot of laws and protections, and it is a very complex issue of how to address. So again, just another kind of unintended consequence, or where we're seeing more legal complications. It's not directly special ed law, but you're going to see these in your union negotiations.
Yeah, and I'll just flag, in the proposed final rules, they do actually explicitly say that isolated timeout is prohibited, which was not included in the emergency rules. And it does include a definition of isolated timeout, which is involuntary confinement of a student alone in a room or clearly defined area from which the student is physically prevented from leaving. So I think that helps at least clarify, as opposed to just deleting the word isolated everywhere, is to specifically define that term and say that it is not permitted. Okay, so like I said, when we just deleted the word isolated, it created some confusion about what timeout is. That definition started to look really, really broad, right? It just says behavior management technique that involves monitored separation of a student from classmates with a trained adult for a limited time in a non-locked setting. That seemed like it was going to apply to all kinds of interventions that you guys do on a daily basis with kids, right? Removing a student from that situation in a monitored way. I mean, when a student goes to see the social worker, when the student goes to the sensory room, an in-school suspension, we had all kinds of questions on this. ISBE's FAQ has clarified that that is not the intent of this definition. And I think if you look then to the proposed rules, they do provide a little bit more specificity about what is a timeout. And so looking at that, we're talking about, it's a behavior management technique for the purpose of calming or de-escalation that involves involuntary monitored separation of a student from classmates with a trained adult for part of the school day. So the guidance has said, we're not talking about detention. We are not talking about asking a student to step into the hallway to have a conversation about a behavior. This is not when a student needs a calming break, if you have a calming area of the classroom. That's not what time out means. Those sorts of interventions do not need to be documented the way an actual timeout does. When we're talking about an actual timeout, we're talking about a situation where the student's behavior has become so escalated that they are a safety risk. They need de-escalation. It is involuntary. We're usually going to a separate room because we have these safety requirements of the room, right? There shouldn't be wires. There shouldn't be other materials that the student might use to injure him or herself. So when you're in a classroom and the student is escalated and the only option is to clear the other students from the class, that's not a timeout. Okay, and ISBE has said they do not view that as a timeout. It does not need to be documented as a timeout. You may still need to document that for the purposes of the student's behavior intervention plan and be monitoring how often that kind of intervention is used, but it would not be considered a timeout. So we're getting a little bit more clarity about that, but I think this was one of the questions we got the most when the emergency rules first came out. So just to review, when you're doing a timeout, it has to be with a trained adult, and the training for adults who are monitoring timeout has changed. Previously, it was just to be familiar with the district's policies on the use of timeout, and now there are additional requirements that Jennifer will talk about shortly. Timeout room needs to be in an unlocked setting. The adult could stand to block the entrance or exit. They cannot put furniture or other sort of immobile objects to block the exit. And the enclosure, like I said, needs to meet certain health and safety requirements. Additionally, there are time limits. A student should not be kept in timeout longer than when they are causing the safety risk. We have had some questions about, well, what if a student just needs to stay there once they're the immediate threat has passed, to fully de-escalate, process the situation, if immediately moving back to the classroom would immediately cause another escalation. And in ISBE's FAQ, they have said, that's fine if you need to keep the student there for another time to complete that cooling down process. But the student should not be in this room for an extended period of time is the takeaway. Physical restraints, I think the biggest change in the initial emergency rules was the prohibition of prone and supine restraint, which are used in some of the management techniques that some schools and some districts do use. An amendment was issued that allows the use of these interventions in very limited circumstances, and the final rules continue to allow supine restraint, so that's face up, in these very limited circumstances, but prohibit prone restraints. So there were a lot of questions, especially from the private therapeutic schools that I think are more likely to use some of these interventions, about, you know, we don't have a whole lot of other options. Sometimes this is the last option when a student is very escalated and very dangerous, and that is why, you know, ISB did do that amendment to allow for these interventions in these very limited circumstances. But these are the more dangerous, risky types of holds where students have been injured. And so we want to raise the level of awareness and caution when using this type of restraint. The rules also provide some additional guidance in the final proposed rules that, like I said, are not in effect yet. They are still accepting comments about these. Also then add on some additional rules related to physical restraint, and especially when that physical restraint needs to end, right? So it should end when the immediate danger has ended. They've added a line here that I think is interesting. It says when the student indicates that he or she cannot breathe, and when the student is observed to be in severe distress. So we need to be monitoring that student carefully. There should be somebody assigned to be monitoring how is that student doing, and is this intervention an appropriate and safe thing to continue, or do we need to change gears because it's not safe for the student at that point? What next, right? What do we do if we do have a situation where we were previously using some of these interventions that are not available anymore, and we need to keep this student and other students safe? And in the immediate term, there aren't a lot of really good options, right? If a student is unsafe in your building, you can call 911, you can call SAS, you can call the parent to come pick the student up, right? These are not things we want to be doing on a regular basis. We need to be having our IEP teams get back together, pulling in the resources that you have in your district as far as your social workers, psychologists, BCBA, behavior management specialist, whoever you have, and possibly consulting with outside experts to try and figure out other interventions that can work for these kids who have this highest level of need. But in that immediate term, in that situation where a student is escalated to a point where you're kind of out of tools, calling for that emergency help is sort of your last option that is still available to you. And I think I'll kind of hand it over to Jennifer, but we do get a question a lot. Okay, so we called the parent and said, you need to take the student home. They just cannot be de-escalated to the point where they can be safe and, you know, productive at school today. Is that a suspension?
Great, and that's where I'll pick up. So, first of all, I just want to acknowledge this is a very unusual room. I see many, many of you. We sit across the table. So I just want to start off by saying I'm pulling the curtain back. None of this should be repeated to me at an IEP team, that this is our advice. I feel like this is one of those words will be held against me situations. But nevertheless, this is a great dialogue. This is an important issue. So please tell me if you disagree, and we'll continue the discussion. First major issue that we see is, okay, you can't restrain. Like Kendra said, you see a need for probably continued restraints. We have all these limitations on doing that. So what's the first thing you do? Maybe you send the kid home, right? You send the kid home, but then can you do that? What does that mean? You kick into SB 100. So the first thing I would say is my guidance is if the school's requiring the kid to go home, it's your choice, you're sending them, it is a suspension. Okay, even for a part day, if it's your choice, it is a suspension, get out your suspension paperwork. Because the key thing about suspensions is you need to give all that process and notice. So there's no such thing as just informally taking the rest of the day off, although I do hear that a lot. We're just giving them the rest of the day off. That's not a thing. It's a suspension. Or the other thing I will say, if the parent makes the decision and tells you, I'm deciding to take my kid home, I want to take him to the doctor, I want to, whatever I want to do, it's my decision, I'm taking him home, I do not consider that a suspension. Because parents can decide to take their kids out of school, and we never consider that a suspension, whether it's excused, I would put it excused. You're like, yes, that's fine, you know, definitely excused. So those are your two options. So again, as far as the length of the time out of the building, when you make the decision the student has to go home, under SB 100, what I advise is how long does your team need to get ready for the kid to come back? Okay, so depending on, do you just need a day where everyone needs to de-escalate, problem solve, they can come back to the next day? Or are we talking about you're maybe consulting with other staff, this is going to take a few days for you to get some other ideas because this can't keep happening, so then maybe it's a 1 to 3 day suspension. If it was so big, we need to majorly rethink what we're doing with this kid. We need 2 weeks, you know, maybe you go up to 10 days. But that's how you're basically gauging how long is the student going to be out, when can they come back. And all of that you would document with your SB 100 suspension paperwork, and I think it is going to be illegal. SB 100 would allow this type of suspension because it is absolutely needed for safety and disruption, right? We talked about room clears, we talked about threat to self or others. I think you're going to meet those standards. Okay. Outplacement, the other major impact that we're seeing, and I think is likely the driver of the emergency or the amendments to the emergency rules, is outplacements and the impact here. So first of all, these rules, as Bea is saying, do apply to outplacements. That means they need to do the paperwork, but you schools are still always on the hook for FAPE at the end of the day. And not doing the paperwork right is at least a procedural violation, and depending on what else is going on, could lead to a substantive violation of FAPE. So they do the paperwork, but you do need to be monitoring that they're doing. So a lot of times I get the question, well, they messed up, the day school messed up, we're not in trouble, right? Well, no, they're serving the kid on your behalf. You have a monitoring obligation here, so there's still obligations on the district to monitor that all this is happening and going correctly. So when I say the major impact, what happened was day schools are saying, okay, well, we can't serve some of these kids then if we don't have these interventions available to us. They're not appropriate, and we're doing a 30-day notice, or we're not going to accept. So we did get the amendments to the emergency rules, allowing them in some circumstances. I really see this as one of the biggest issues going forward, because I continue to have, yesterday I was at an IEP meeting, school district agreed to residential. The kid recently had a major incident where emergency responders, they had to send like 12 emergency responders to restrain the student. Well, now all the school, you know, we're sending out packets. There is like this many schools on the ISBIA list, even residential schools, that are going to take someone who requires that significant of restraint. They can see that coming a mile away, and as you know, these spots fill up so quickly, they're going to take a less involved kid for any open spots. It's really, really, really a problem. Not to say, and there's all the problems you're going to hear about with the report, all the concerns about student safety, but there's a certain population of students who we can't keep safe without these tools. Even our outplacements can't. So then what? Where are you? Okay, no schools will take the kid. None. What do you do? Well, homebound at the library? How's that a good long-term plan for a kid who just got taken out by 12 emergency responders? You know, so we, as far as what I would like to see the discussion evolve to, it's those really, sometimes I think the kids who actually need residential are the ones who can't get into residential, you know, and I think we need to continue to have that discussion about how do we serve our really, really severe high needs students who, it's really, when I hear just more training, or we're going to talk about restorative practices. You know, this girl that I was at the meeting yesterday, she lunged and bit her dad's arm and thinks she's an animal and was clawing. Restorative practices? You know, what? That makes zero sense. So just acknowledge, yes, there's some that was abused, and that's, but there's a totally another category and layer of need here that really doesn't effectively get addressed with these new rules. So, outplacements. Okay, next. Oh, talk softer.
Sorry.
next, meeting effectiveness. Okay, the rules changed here. There used to be an ability to, basically the parent could opt out of certain meetings, certain notices. Now we're saying you should meet every three restraints regardless. There is an exception about if it's a therapeutic restraint, you don't need to meet every three times. We're not clear what is a therapeutic versus a safety restraint. It's not defined, it's not, Kendra and I have actually spent a lot of time brainstorming about what is a therapeutic restraint. And the thing that we're, I guess where I was landing was if a therapist recommended it, so if we have a report and the therapist is telling you to do it for therapy, then it's therapeutic. But the difference between a safety, so we're just saying at this point until we get some clarity, meet every three restraints, then you definitely comply with this. The parents can no longer waive the requirement about getting paperwork. So they're gonna get all the paperwork every 24 hours. Let's see. And so where does that lead to? You're meeting every three restraints. Well, it's inevitably gonna lead to discussions about placement. And as school attorneys, sometimes I know my clients want to serve their students in their community and their schools. And I genuinely think it's better for students. They have better outcomes. And the frustrating thing about these new rules is they drive discussions to pushing students to more restrictive placements. Because it's, okay, we've met three times. We aren't solving the need for restraint here. So we're gonna, you know, at some point, it's gonna come up. An outplacement is gonna come up, and the whole system is kind of set up, these new rules, to push the problem further away. And that's kind of a sad outcome, I think, because I do think you do such wonderful things for students in your schools. I think we have better outcomes when we keep students in our public schools. Outplacements should be a last resort. But that's where we are with this. I think there's some situations where you're just not going to have the capacity or design your programs in a way that's going to support some of these students in your school that you were supporting previously. Okay, with that, we'll go to policy. There is a requirement that you change your policy. Basically, you're going to take the same black marker that is be used in cross-out isolated. Because things are still in progress, some districts are updating their procedures, some are waiting for the final rulemaking, whatever works for your culture. The problem is that obviously the emergency rules are effective now, so you do want to be able to inform your staff on what the requirements are, but yet you know that things keep evolving, so it somewhat makes sense to wait till things settle out, but also you want to appropriately communicate with your staff what the current requirements are. Okay. This is a new form that came out of the emergency rulemaking, and it's the first time that ISB put out a form specifically for you to document seclusion and restraint. There used to be requirements that you document certain things, and it was a list of things that basically are also on this form, but everyone made their own forms. And so I'll be interested what the reporters say, but some of you got FOIAs, and you don't have to create documents, but depending on exactly how it was described, you might say, well, we don't have that, because you kept your own thing and you called it something else, but it was basically this. Now we're all actually you're going to be using the same form. So now if you're FOIA'd and it says ask for the physical and restraint form, there's no saying we don't have, everyone's going to have the actual form, whereas before you might, we don't do that exactly. There are some things to note. There's some, for example, there's no place to check whether it's a therapeutic or a safety, even though the rules have different requirements, like we talked about before. There's also a place to document that the nurse has evaluated the student. Some of you might not have nurses, obviously. That is not a requirement in the regs. That is just on the form. So obviously do it if you have a nurse and the student might be injured. It's not a bad idea. If you don't have a nurse, an administrator can give the kid a once over and document there, maybe scratch out the nurse. But just wanted to confirm, you're not missing something in the regs. That's not a requirement, it's just on the form. The form asks for a list of personnel who participated in the intervention. We're saying this means name and title. A key thing, I'm going to talk about training next that's required. I would say from a legal liability perspective, the key training for your staff is how to fill out this form, right? So I think there's a lot of situations where you're only doing the physical restraint because there is a safety concern present. But you need to describe it in a way on this form so whoever reads the form understands the safety concern present. So think about that when you're deciding who fills out the form. I mean, I would still say be objective, factual of what's happening, but obviously pick out the key events that are leading you to the conclusion. Make sure that those make it onto the paper, why the kid's a safety threat. You know, some ancillary comment, you can include it, but we just want to make sure the reader, when you get FOIA'd and the same reporters you're going to hear from, when they get this, are they going to understand why you had to do the timeout or the physical restraint? Or if you send it to your lawyers, when we just read it, or if you just show your colleague, could just an average person pick up the form and understand why it was needed? If so, I think you've met the test. But if sometimes you get the forms and you're like, yeah, I have no idea what happened here, that's a problem in how we're documenting and describing. So again, this is my actual priority in training, but we're going to next talk about the actual training requirements.
And I would just say, with filling out those forms, one thing that I think sometimes we are hesitant to write down specifics, and we write things in generalities, like the student was escalated, the student was physically aggressive. And I don't think that's good enough, right? That doesn't give the parent, that doesn't give your superintendent or the state board or a reporter a really good idea of why it was necessary to use this intervention. So be specific. The student picked up the laptop and was about to crush it on this other student's head, right? The student was kicking me 5 times. The student, whatever specifically was happening that was causing the need for this intervention, we want to document that objectively and with specificity as opposed to in generalized terms.
All right, training. So the emergency rules require training in de-escalation, restorative practice, behavior management techniques. We think probably your training already covers these that you do for example, CPI training, or your de-escalation and restraint training generally covers these topics, maybe with the exception of restorative practices, which, again, I think of that more in the context of a way of conflict resolution between students, which is not the scenario I usually see restraint being used in. And I don't think that Kendra and I have mentioned it, but there continues to be the exception of momentary touching of a student to stop them from a safety issue. That's not a restraint. So you walk up to a fight and you put your hand on someone's shoulder, still not a restraint. Kid's about to lunge into the street, into oncoming traffic, you know, just doesn't see a car coming. You grab the student, not a restraint. So all those things both don't need to be documented. So there's times you can still touch students, not a restraint, including to break up a fight possibly. But yet we do have the reference to restorative practices, so that possibly would be covered in your more disciplinary type training than necessarily the de-escalation. The proposed regs are quite extensive, the training requirement. It now says 8 hours annual training, so a full day, crisis, de-escalation, restorative practices, identifying signs of distress during physical restraint and timeout, trauma-informed practices, behavior management practices, less restrictive and intrusive strategies. So we'll see if that requirement remains in, but that would be a very, very significant training requirement. With that, we have a new complaint process. New complaint process looks pretty much like the old complaint process, but this is just specific to this. It's similar to state complaints where someone just sends in a complaint to ISB. They're gonna investigate just like they do state complaints on other topics. They can order action or technical assistance. Parents are being told to file these. If they're calling ISB with complaints, they're being directed. I have not seen a flood of these with our clients. I don't know if you...
No, we haven't seen a flood. I do know some of the districts who were mentioned in the initial article have received complaints from ISB that just say, see article. So there have been a series of those.
Right. But that is, so again, possible to expect, haven't seen it. Initially, when the first article came out, we had a total flurry. I don't know if you remember, the second article came out, we had just gone on, basically it was right before Christmas, it might have been that Monday before, and I was thinking, oh, don't ruin our, holiday break, come on. But actually, I think by then we were all knew the deal, kind of expected it, and I didn't see like a flood of complaints over the break and haven't seen them in January yet. Okay. And with that, we'll turn to questions.
Did anybody write any questions down in the papers that we passed out, or anybody want to just shout out a question? We've got microphones. Everybody.
You mentioned a girl who had bit her father and was pretending like she was an animal, and it sounded like you were implying that there was no way that she could be helped or reached through restorative practices or any other non-adversarial or non-punitive interventions. So I'm wondering if you can say a little bit more about that, and do you really believe there's no way that staff could have prevented her from escalating in the first place?
So the scenario I was describing happened in the home, not school. The parents were trying to get the student to go to the emergency room. She ran out in the snow in bare feet. Father tried to intervene because she wasn't safe running out in the snow in bare feet, and she significantly bit his arm. I do think in that scenario, to keep her safe, there was no way to get her emergency medical service without the emergency responders made the decision that physical restraint was required. So we then have to report that to treating facilities. And so they're gonna consider that she is a student who requires physical restraint to be managed. That's just the way that situation will be received when they do the enrollment. If that same thing happened at school, I would also say, so elopement that's unsafe, so if you're running out, no shoes, into the world, then we call the police, and they will end up restraining. I am saying in that basic fact pattern, without revealing any specific identifiable information, that is going to be considered a student who requires as a need restraint. I don't know enough about her personally to know if with proper, in the future, will she be intervened? In that moment, the professionals were there, decided she required restraint.
And I think there's a difference between that, like in the moment, do you need a physical restraint versus programmatically, holistically, what are the different interventions we can do to prevent that kind of escalation? So I think there's kind of the two-pronged approach to looking at these issues.
So I have a question. Why doesn't someone call an ambulance instead of 911 or the police?
Well, when I say 911, I do mean an ambulance.
I mean, for those extreme situations. And instead of, like, saying we're calling the police, which seems has a real punitive feel, I work with a lot of kids with mental health issues, so I would say to the police, are you crisis trained? And can you, can you bring, we may need to transport this child to the hospital and they need to be assessed.
Yeah. So I would say a couple things about that. One, we get parents who sometimes ambulance rides are expensive and the copay is expensive, and we get so much pushback about ambulance rides as opposed to sometimes free police intervention if you have a resource officer. But regardless, I do think we rely on ambulances, and that's something that really escalates it with parents. Parents do not like those ambulance rides. It's actually.
It is very counterintuitive, but in some communities where parents don't have health insurance, an ambulance ride can result in a $10,000, $15,000 bill. Whereas, and I do recommend to my clients that if they have to call 911 in any mental health emergency, that you see if you have a mental health crisis team, because that makes all the difference. Like there's probably nobody here from Skokie, but I had to call them once in Skokie. Amazing. Amazing to de-escalate someone who was clearly having a mental health crisis. They did so in a respectful, they didn't restrain. They finally, it took 2 hours, but they talked to the student for 2 hours and got her to lay and let the firemen put her in the ambulance. But when you have certain communities, the ambulance cost is just so prohibitive. It is horrible to call the police, but the police take you to the emergency room for free.
Just one thing. With Medicaid patients, when SAS evaluates the patient, if they feel the student should be hospitalized, they're covering the ambulance. This is why a lot of schools won't send a child to an ER, or even hold a child until SAS evaluates them at the school. I don't think it's worth the risk. I think you should get them to the ER as soon as possible. I think the potential risk is not worth it. It's worth the potential risk of having the payment.
We have a comment over here.
So we're in a district that's large enough that we're fortunate enough to house a lot of our specialized programs within our district. Part of those programs have emotional disability programs specific to kids that struggle. I guess where we're struggling with the emergency rules, the guidance document helped, but we have kids who will become dysregulated. They will not be an imminent danger to themselves or somebody else, but we do remove them involuntarily to support them to therapeutically provide interventions. So I guess in the new emergency rules, what I guess we're struggling with is when do we fill out the timeout form? If we're involuntarily removing them from that environment, they are not at a risk, but we are providing therapeutic intervention, would it be appropriate not to fill out that form and document that intervention somewhere else? And if that's the case, is it then that the two factors are for filling out the form, involuntarily removal and imminent danger?
Yeah, I would say we're looking at that imminent danger piece to make it a timeout, and we're looking at a timeout room, right? If you are requiring the student to go with you on a walk down the hallway or to the sensory room or to a different classroom that doesn't have a class of students in it, I would not consider that a timeout. That, I think you're going to be doing those positive therapeutic interventions. What counts as a timeout is really in that timeout room. We're talking about that, small, empty space that is, a timeout room.
So what about the gen ed students who get affected by the students who have these behaviors within the classroom and their education is being disruptive? And I ask that because I believe I have 4 emails just this week in regards to it.
This is something I have an ongoing due process on this issue right now as well. I think it's part of being in an inclusive environment is you are impacted by the disabilities of your classmates. And, I think that is just part of it. And it's impossible to say gen ed kid, you don't have to have any impact or see any impact on having a disabled peer in your class. Now, I know that it gets to a certain point, and one of the factors for change of placement is if it's so disruptive to the, you know, others' education. So that's a factor we do consider when we're looking at restrictiveness. And if it's to a certain level where others aren't learning, then you do consider more restrictive.
So I'm a behavior specialist for a school district, and just to kind of give some input or clarity maybe on the use of therapeutic restraint, I mean, I think the definition of therapeutic would mean that we were looking for a result in a behavior change, and if restraint is to be used solely for safety and not for punishment or something like that, I actually would argue that there are not therapeutic restraints. That would be something that I would say. And going along with that, if the new kind of proposed language is that we're supposed to be meeting after every three restraints unless it's therapeutic, I guess I have concerns with staff beginning to just restrain over and over and over again to be able to get to move forward with conversations regarding outplacement and those kinds of things. So I guess I don't know if there's any room for like additional input on what that would look like as far as defining that and just making it very clear that like just because you restrain a kid nine times doesn't mean necessarily that the IEP team has to decide to move them to an outplacement, I would think, right? Especially if the school's not, employing like proactive, positive measures and they're just restraining. I don't know if it's a question other than can you speak to what that's really supposed to look like and what kind of protections could be put in place for those kinds of things?
Yeah, I mean, I would say on a couple levels, you can still submit comments to ISBE about the proposed rules. So please, you know, if you have things after looking over the proposed rules, do, you know, send them to ISBE directly, send them to IAASE, your attorney, make sure that those are heard. With respect to meeting every three times, that doesn't limit you from meeting after the first time or just meeting proactively before it's used. If you think that you have a student whose behavior is not being managed appropriately, who needs different interventions or possibly a different placement, get your team together. You do not have to wait for three times.
Just a quick question. Okay. I appreciate the state saying, gee, there's a problem here. There should be less restraint. You know, kids are at risk. How about the concept, every school that I'm a child psychiatrist, every school that I work with, therapeutic school, residential or day school, in the last number of years, talk about the costs, negative budgets, cutting back on staff. There are points as salaries increase, what have you, that the reimbursement rates need to go up so they can get the staff they need so they can develop the de-escalation techniques, the interventions for what frankly have seemed to be progressively more complex kids. There doesn't seem to be a discussion on that side, and I was just curious if any thoughts.
We disagree with that. I have not heard that discussion. It needs to be had. It needs to be part of this. These are really expensive educations to fund. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Good morning. Earlier, we were touching on hospitalizing children, sending them to the emergency room, use of ambulances, et cetera. In the city of Chicago, but also in a wider perspective across the state of Illinois, there's actually a decrease in child and adolescent psychiatric beds that are available. Many of us hear numerous stories of children who spend days in emergency rooms and then ultimately get sent home. And so I do think that we need to be careful about making those kinds of plans or building that in immediately into a school or an organization's response system and really understanding the layers of that. Additionally, I would just add that it is not uncommon now to see many students who have been psychiatrically hospitalized upwards of one dozen or two dozen times, which is something that also, I think, as a full school continuum, I don't know that we do enough to really address. Those are cycles that can be broken, but they're complicated. and there needs to be room to work to intervene on those cycles for kids, which we are seeing more and more frequently.
Thank you for sharing that. I guess I would just comment too, as we're seeing those students who are repeatedly psychiatrically hospitalized often don't have IEPs. They go to the hospital, they come back, you know, they maybe get A's in all AP classes. So your staff, no one's referring them for child find. I think that's a huge red flag as to how to bring them in and get them support during the day. So definitely well taken.
I have a couple of quick questions, just two quick questions. You mentioned that when the school personnel is overseeing a physical restraint, one of the things they need to be watching for is whether or not the student indicates that they can't breathe. In our therapeutic day school, we sometimes have students in a restraint who say they can't breathe, but they obviously are able to. I mean, they're speaking. They say that as a way to be released. So is that going to be a problem if someone's overseeing
that?
That
was my first thought when I read that as well, is that could be manipulated.
Right.
And I think I would encourage you to voice that concern to ISBE, because that is currently not part of the that rule is not final yet. And so they're accepting comments, and so I would provide that feedback and that concern.
Thank you. And then the other one was just about every three restraints, hold an IEP meeting. Is there any timeline there? What if there's a restraint this year, a restraint next fall, and a third one next spring?
Is that three restraints per school year, basically? Or is it three restraints?
I don't. Yeah, I think it doesn't say, and so that also, you know, is something we could flag for ISBE for further clarification. You know, a conservative reading would be ever. I think a reasonable interpretation that could be defended would also be the school year, but I don't think it specifically says right now.
I'm Diane. I work in a school district, and my question is really about, do you see school districts in the future, because of this, having to take more medical responsibility for students? Like, for example, right now we're very clear, you know, if you want to medicate your child for this, you can, but we're, as the school, not telling you to do so. But in those extreme cases where, like the students we're talking about, if the parents aren't taking that step, do you see the school district having to do that?
That is completely off limits by the law. You cannot touch on that. You cannot, as a school, recommend medication. You can't comment or judge the parent for not medicating. I think common sense, and in the back of everyone's head sometimes, is this: it gets to a point everyone's thinking the student maybe needs medication, but you cannot. That's a violation of the law. You can't go there. So should it go there? Will the discussion go there? Maybe. But right now it's definitely off limits, which holds your hand, because it's an obvious intervention that, like I said, many people would think, hey, this is a situation that calls for it.
With the issue around the 10-day notice to parents regarding a meeting following three holds, if we schedule that meeting and after the three holds but before the meeting occurs there are two more holds, can the parents waive a 10-day notice so we can do one meeting on those five, or do we have to wait for hold number six and then do another 10-day notice?
Yeah, I mean, I think work with your parents. Communicate, make sure it's documented. They can certainly waive the 10-day notice. They can say, I'm not gonna attend this one. You know, we've had too many meetings. You guys meet, send me the paperwork. That's up to parents and how you have, you know, your relationship with parents to make sure that that communication is there. But yeah, it's every three times, and they get the notice, and then they could have it sooner if they wanted.
Hi, I'm Wendy. I'm a school psychologist in training actually here at Loyola. I was wondering if you could speak to some of the specifics of the increased training requirements, particularly in terms of standardization, who would be receiving the training, and district resources being allocated to that.
Yeah, so everybody who is involved in monitoring a timeout or involved in a physical restraint would need to have the training. The more extensive training, the 8-hour training, is in the proposed rule, so that is not currently in effect. I don't think it's intended that it has to be an 8-hour training. I think if you have 2 hours here and 2 hours there, you know, it just needs to add up to 8 hours over the course of the year. In conversations with ISBE, they said they are reviewing the, like, CPI training, Menta training, other kinds of intervention systems that a lot of districts use to see if they comply with the requirements so that they can then say, yes, if you're using this, it's going to check all the boxes. But we don't have all the specifics on that yet because that part is not final.
Any other questions? Oh, go in here.
So you talked about the definition of timeout and the spaces that can be used for that. And in my experience, most public school buildings don't have spaces that meet those requirements. However, sometimes we are engaging in things that I would consider to be timeout. So if a student goes to a sensory room and is unable to de-escalate and we end up blocking that student from leaving the sensory room and they are engaged in dangerous behavior, to me that's a timeout, but it's not in a timeout space. Would you say that's a timeout? Should we document that as a timeout? Or shall we act as though it's not?
Well, here's the problem. If we call it a timeout, it was an illegal timeout because it didn't comply with the space. If you say that if you don't block the door, then now you can't really meet the student's needs because presumably they're escalated and they will escalate further and now put others in harm. So now your placement doesn't meet the student's needs. And so that's the tug I feel with these rules and why I'm saying it's driving more restrictive placements. And so to the extent we can, in good faith and honestly, continue to say it's a sensory break, we're going to be able to maintain the kid. Like I said, if you have to say that we're blocking, you can't do that, so now we're changing placement or redesigning schools. But I agree. I've been surprised. I've started to find compliant rooms in schools I didn't know that had them, but you're right, for the most part, schools do not have these rooms.
I guess going to an earlier question around a student in a general education setting, I work in education advocacy work in Chicago, and I'm wondering what supports and training those educators are getting to help support those students, because from what I hear with various teachers who do have experience with these students, it's little to no training or support, and even no collaboration time with the special education team in order to learn about this student and learn the resources and supports that maybe the school has to offer.
Yeah, I've certainly seen that concern where you have a student, even a student who does have an IEP but might be in the general education setting for part of the day, and that general education teacher might not have CPI or other de-escalation or physical restraint training. And it's hard. In an ideal world, you'd give everybody all the training, but it's costly and it takes a lot of time, and so I think that's a real difficult balance, is to get as many people trained as you can, get people that collaboration time, have your crisis team on call with a way if you know the student's in a general ed class and escalates to the point where they need a physical restraint and that teacher's not trained, they need to be able to get in touch with somebody who is very quickly so someone else can be there to help. So putting those plans in place, but it is a balance trying to get the right supports throughout the building.
Okay, a lot of great questions, and I think really demonstrates the complexity of this issue, and also, you know, obviously this was just the legal overview, and we've touched on a lot of areas here. A lot of it is still gray. We're certainly pending the outcome of the final rulemaking. Obviously, if there's legislation as well, that's going to impact this area. So a lot of questions still, a lot of good discussion. We're seeing folks from all sides of this issue, and I think it's a great dialogue and why we're here. So really excited about that, and thank you all for those questions. We are going to transition now to the panel discussion. So it's just going to take us a couple minutes if you want to talk amongst yourself, if you need to take a quick break. But we're going to try to move into this in the next couple of minutes. So thank you.
Okay. Yeah, that's good to know. Yeah. That's really good to know. Yeah. Thank you.
And you start so I know I saw.
I think it usually comes up in different situations.
I'm not
a stranger. The first time out is the immediate. Mostly the way I'm learning the things around me in this moment. And the process was typically I have a plan, I've made a threat. I think it just has to I think for kids where you're having that, where it is a safety threat to the whole class or to a particular directive to their teacher, then it makes sense after that one.
Yeah.
I think pulling in that side of it as well and trying to collaborate makes a lot of sense. But it's hard because you've got whole different groups of people and different systems, different like processes are going through. Because I think, right, yes, that is, you have to have the team in place and ready to go, and there are going to be times when it overlaps, and you kind of need assessment on both sides, and planning on both sides. So,
thank you.
Yeah.